60 years ago, US President Dwight Eisenhower gave currency to the expression the military-industrial complex, the relationship between a country's military and the defence industry that supplies it. Investigative reporter and Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, Andrew Coburn, has devoted a large part of his career examining the military-industrial complex. And his latest book is a collection of his articles under the title The Spoils of War, Power, Profit and the American War Machine. In it, Coburn expands on his theme that the United States' appetite for war is driven by the military's eagerness for ever more money, shared with the corporations that feed off it, as well as the officers who will cash in with high-paid employment with those same corporations once they retire. Andrew Coburn is with us now. Hello.
Hey, good morning.
Very nice to talk to you. Coburn is a prestigious name in the world of journalism, is it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, for rather than seek a decent, honest living, that's a lot of my family have, including myself included, have defaulted to journalism. My father, my two brothers, I've got two nieces. We all ended up as journalists. So.
Claude, Alexander, Patrick, here you are now, Andrew Coburn. Let me ask you first, because it's breaking news, that a U.S. military investigation into a Kabul drone strike in August found that it killed 10 civilians, and the driver and the vehicle targeted was likely not a threat. Now, you don't talk about the efficacy of drones so much. You talk about the lack of efficacy of enormously expensive aircraft. I wondered if you had any comment to make on these drone strikes being wrong.
Right. Well, I don't talk about them in this book, though I did write another book, actually all about drones. I called it Drones and the Rise of the High-Tech Assassins. And I'm afraid this tragedy in Kabul, I mean, shouldn't really have come as a surprise. I mean, shouldn't have come about at all. It really comes from this myth, really, that the ability, the technological ability to pinpoint a target on the other side of the world and, strike it and take it out somehow conveys, magical powers of perception and intelligence. Whereas it doesn't. I mean, yes, they can hit a target precisely, but it leads to overconfidence that you're hitting the right target. And, we've had so many examples over the 20 years plus of drone use where this has happened. I mean, this happened to be because this happened in a city swarming with journalists, and particularly egregious in that they killed not just an innocent family, but a someone who had actually worked for the Americans, someone they were supposedly protecting, just makes it all the more tragic. But it was, it just shows that when they claim to have superior intelligence and be able to spot the right target and take it out, they can so often be a deadly mistake.
Given the recent events in Afghanistan and further back, the rise of the Taliban and the exit of the United States and its allies, let's begin with your first chapter in this book. It's about the killing, once again, of an Afghan farmer called Shafiullah and his family, because, as you describe it, an A-10 attack plane pilot was overruled by a B-1 pilot. I'm simplifying here. Please explain the significance of that.
Sure. Briefly, what happened was two A-10 pilots were flying their planes on patrol in Afghanistan, and they got an order to attack a particular target, which was supposedly an enemy, a Taliban force attacking American, in contact with American troops. And they flew, they inspected the target and said, no, it's just an innocent farm, farm family. They're bringing the animals into the night. It was coming on to dusk, so bringing in the sheep and the goats. And the instructor, the ground commander, who was some miles away, said, no, it's enemy attack at once. And they refused, and then a B-1 bomber agreed to take the mission and duly dropped its bombs and wiped out an innocent farm family. And the significance of the story, apart from being, you know, just one more horrible tragedy, is that this notion that, you know, you can attack an enemy you can't see, you can attack targets you can't see. And it's like the Kabul drone strike we just talked about. The A-10 is a plane specifically designed to allow the pilot to fly low, even when it's under fire, because it's sort of very well armored and protected, and has very good views of the ground, so the pilot can see what's going on. And, you know, in this case, could see that this was not a proper target and therefore refused to bomb it. The B-1, meanwhile, was literally miles overhead, and they were just looking at basically, you know, computer screens and aiming by computer, and, you know, we really had no idea what they were aiming at, were far removed from the reality of the situation, and just, you know, blithely loosed off their bombs and kill people. And as I say, it's one tragedy among many, but it really points to a very important theme and a very central theme of my book, which is this whole sort of notion that you can use technology to substitute for direct observation, for you know, the technology separates people from reality in war, and then in many other ways too, but in warfare, and this has led to horrible consequences.
Well, you don't get much more horrible than the Somme, right? I mean, is it more horrible than that?
Well, you know, it hasn't, although, you know, the latest counts for Afghanistan, I don't know, I mean, well over 100,000 people killed. No, I mean, you know, there's always, well, it doesn't get more horrible than the firebombing of Tokyo in March 1945, 100,000 people killed in the night, civilians. So you could always say, well, it's better, you can always find something worse, but it's this, you know, this is the direction in which we're moving. It's a belief that technology, as I say, technology somehow makes the bad parts of war go away. I mean, no one said that rushing across an open field into machine guns was making something worse go away, as with the Somme. This is, you know, this is a pretense that we're somehow making war cleaner and more controllable, and in a way tamer. And the opposite is true, that it makes it more indiscriminate and more dangerous, because people, politicians and leaders, they think, oh, well, it's okay, we can just use a drone. We send off a drone, we don't get any of our people killed, so there's no political risk, and we can, you know, take care of the problem with the remote killing, I mean, which has been very much part of the drone campaign. And that's very dangerous, because it means it makes war seem easier, as I say, more controllable and, you know, less politically risky, which is going to lead to much more dangerous situations.
Further than that, you suggest that the more expensive a weapon is, the F-35 fighter, for example, the more the military wants it, because the more the aerospace industry wants it. And this is the military-industrial complex. There's the B-1 that we mentioned, $300 million, which you say left a trail of havoc in Afghanistan in the form of dead civilians and soldiers. Is the military really that stupid?
Well, I wouldn't call it stupid. Just depends what the objective is. You know, in some ways you can say they're being very clever if you put aside the idea that their intent is to defend the country in an effective and, you know, and also cost effective way as possible. In that case, it's very stupid to be using a $300 million bomber, which was originally developed and designed to go to Moscow at supersonic speeds and drop nuclear weapons on Moscow, which is what the B-1 was originally sold as. You know, that was its advertised mission, and to use it to protect, you know, small units of American soldiers on a mountain somewhere in Afghanistan. And as you know, I have another story in the book about what happened when they do that, is obviously very stupid. But if you think, hey, $300 million to, to, you know, important corporations across America, you know, and part of that will come back in the form of not just votes from workers, but campaign contributions, jobs for generals when they retire, you know, profits all around, then it's a very sensible way to proceed. You just have to think about what is really at stake.
As you've written recently in a column, the departure of American troops from Afghanistan is a whole, the end of an adventure which has been a thumping success for the US military and what you say is the multitude of interested parties who feed at its trough. Trillions of taxpayer dollars have flowed through their budgets and profits over the two decades. Are you talking about corruption or are you just talking about delusion?
Really, corruption. I mean, some of it is in, you know, very straightforward corruption, as in, you know, bribes, you know, what we traditionally call corruption. But it's also, it's a form of, you know, intellectual corruption. It's, before I get to intellectual corruption, I'd say, yes, it is corruption. I mean, it is corrupt to pursue a war if the object is to make money. I mean, or to get money for your institution. I relate a story in the book, which I have on very good evidence from someone who was at a meeting in 2018. It was a military officer, a friend and contact of mine, who was a staffer at that point on a headquarters staff. And Donald Trump has just announced a sort of little mini surge in Afghanistan. He'd been persuaded to send more troops temporarily. And the generals, these were all four-star generals discussing, talking about this and saying, well, it won't make any difference in the war, but it'll do us good at budget time. It'll be more money for our service. And my friend was completely disgusted. In fact, he retired soon afterwards because he thought this was so outrageous. And I do too, and I consider that corruption. Even though these generals weren't immediately going to sort of, well, I hope not, sort of trouser large wads of dollar bills, but they were thinking about, you know, this is money for our institution, and that's corrupt. And I'm afraid not delusional at all, very practical in a way.
One of the things you talk about in that article I mentioned is that when the Americans left Afghanistan, it announced that it was sending the Afghan Air Force 37 UH-60 helicopters, which on the face of it, because a new UH-60, as you say, costs something like $12 million, seems extraordinarily generous. What do you say?
Well, I use that to tell that story. I mean, it was a little, you know, another... Actually, since we're talking about corruption, it was a good example of corruption associated with the Afghan war. I mean, very briefly, what had happened was originally the Afghan Air Force had flown a kind of Russian helicopter left over from the days of the Russian war there called MI-17, which was actually ideally suited for war in Afghanistan. It could fly had a very high altitude ceiling, so it could get up to, you know, so much of Afghanistan is mountainous. It was very rugged, didn't break, you know, it could take a lot of damage, and it was comparatively easy to repair. So the Afghans, you know, it was ideally suited for the Afghans, so they knew they could maintain it. The corrupt officer in the American military colluded with the Russian mafia, basically to rip off that program, so they were to... make the sorry, it's a slightly complicated story, but the American army had been buying these Russian helicopters to give to the Afghans until that was fouled up by the a corrupt element in the U.S. army and the Russian mafia in conclusion, so they'd already gotten into the game. So instead, the Afghans were given this American helicopter, the UH-60, which is incredibly complicated to run, very expensive. The Afghans couldn't maintain it on their own, and it couldn't get up to the highest points that it needed to fight in Afghanistan. So I just, it's a slightly complicated story, but it does illustrate so many of the corrupt features of the Afghan war.
Which, as you say, it was one of the scandals that was investigated by John Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. And he told you, you quote him as telling you, that the US wasted a lot of money. It wasn't that people were stupid, and it wasn't that people didn't care. It was the system which almost guarantees failure. What did he mean?
That's right. Well, he meant that the system, what he told me, he pointed out that the reward, the incentive, if you're in the bureaucracy, in the whole Afghan reconstruction bureaucracy, which is what he was principally talking about at that point, the incentive is you get judged on how much money you spend. You know, you're given $100 million, you know, your budget's $100 million, and you're judged as, you know, successful or otherwise, depending on whether you spend that money. And if that money goes, is misspent or is wasted, or the, you know, thing doesn't work, there's no sanction, there's no accountability. So he's saying that, you know, therefore, the reason it guarantees failure is if there's no disincentive to make sure what you're spending money on, you know, works or is effective, then it's going to fail, obviously. As he pointed, the way the system was set up, there was no accountability. He said no one in Afghanistan, and all this fiasco of all the hundreds of billions of dollars wasted, poured away in Afghanistan, no one was, you know, had up on in criminally charged. No one in the bureaucracy lost a promotion. He said, I don't think anyone even lost a bonus. They were all rewarded for doing what the system said they should do, which was to spend money. That's really what he was talking about.
In one article, you describe how the Russian military in 2019, this is going away from Afghanistan now, announced that it had a revolutionary weapon, a hypersonic glide missile. Now, this is an extraordinary story. In response, the US Congress poured money into hypersonics. And you quote in this piece a Pentagon official called Ivan Selin, who in the 1960s Pentagon told newbies that they would be programming weapons that don't work to meet threats that don't exist. Hypersonics is an example of this, you say. What on earth are hypersonics anyway?
Okay. A hypersonic weapon, hypersonic literally or officially means faster than five times the speed of sound. So any weapon, you know, if you're going faster than that, you're traveling at hypersonic speed. Okay, a hypersonic weapon, what they mean by it is, as opposed to a ballistic missile, which also goes very fast, but a ballistic missile, it, you know, goes in an arc, in a parabola. You know, you fire like an artillery gun, you know, you fire the shell and it goes up and sort of curves and then comes down. And that's a predictable, if you've sort of seen where it's, the direction it's heading in when it's fired, you can figure out, you know, where it's going to be along its flight path and where it's going to land. So it makes it, at least in theory, possible to shoot it down. The attraction of hypersonic weapons is that they don't go up into space like, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles. They go up to the sort of top layer of the atmosphere, and then they travel through that. And by traveling through a bit of atmosphere, they can maneuver, you know, like a plane maneuvers by, you know, using its control surfaces. It's on the tail and on the wings, so it can move left and right, up and down to a certain extent. That's the idea of hypersonic, these hypersonic weapons they're talking about. They can maneuver, so it makes it, in theory again, impossible to subtract them and to shoot them down, because you won't know where they're going to be 3 seconds from now, and they're moving at very, very fast speeds, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times the speed of sound. So that's what Putin was claiming the Russians could now do, and therefore get round the American missile defense system. And in response to that, as you said, the Americans said, oh, well, we've got to have the hypersonic weapons too, and are now pouring billions into that. And why, the reason I quoted Ivan Selin was this was, you know, there were the Russians were developing a weapon that didn't work, and I'll explain why in just 1 second, to meet the threat that didn't exist was the American missile defense system, because that's never actually succeeded in a successful test. The reason these hypersonic weapons don't work is that, or they certainly haven't been, no test has made them the essential part work, which is this business I talked about, maneuvering, is because as they maneuver, and I should have said they're gliding. I mean, they're fired up into space on the back of a rocket and then, you know, are let go, not into the edge of space. So they're skipping along the top of the atmosphere. But every time they move left bank, left or right to maneuver, they lose energy. That slows them down. So their range always falls short. So they're a very ineffective weapon, even in theory, and no one's even managed to make them really work in practice in tests that we've done so far. So that, you know, here you have a weapon that doesn't really work, and talking from the Russian point of view, to meet a threat that doesn't exist, which is the American missile system, which doesn't really work because they've never figured out a way to get around decoys. You know, if you launch your missile, your attacking missile with lots of decoys, it's, you know, the defending missile doesn't know which one to aim at. So sorry if I'm sounding, if it gets a little complicated.
No. I mean, what you seem to be saying is that the U.S. military boffins should have realized that Putin was either bluffing or was similarly misled by his own military?
Well, they should have said, but they'd been out of a job in a hurry if they had. Theirs is not the reason why, not the certain reason why in that direction. Here was the prospect. You know, any time you have a threat posed from the other side, it's an invitation to spend money or an offer to be given money. Like years and years ago, there was a big argument in the budget. The U.S. Navy budget was being voted on in Congress, and there was a narrow vote. And just then, a Soviet submarine surfaced just off San Francisco Bay. And the Navy spokesman was asked about this, and he said, we just got lucky, I guess. You know, it's the enemy threat drives the budget. And so, you know, nothing's more attractive than an enemy threat. I mean, believe me, the Chinese anti-submarine works for everyone. The Chinese anti-submarine budget just got a big boost yesterday with the announcement of what the Australians have done.
Yes. Interesting, isn't it? I wanted to ask you about possibly your most controversial chapter in this book, which is entitled The New Red Scare, in which you suggest that the presumption that Russia had manipulated the 2016 election in favor of Donald Trump was an exercise in threat inflation. Are you suggesting there was no substance to that?
I am, and I think, I was saying that at the time, even when they first floated that, because it was I mean, first of all, there was an exercise in Hillary Clinton explaining why she'd lost the election, but by blaming it on the Russians, but then it was used to justify, you know, much greater hostility towards Russia and consequent benefits to the defense budget. But, you know, the Democrats kept this up, and then finally they got Mr. Mueller to do his big investigation, who found no evidence of this whatsoever. So,
The Senate report said that Russia interfered using an influence campaign approved by Putin to help Trump win the presidency. Were they misled?
Well, they alleged. I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee said that, although they didn't produce any evidence for it. And when they did, you know, said, okay, now we'll have the Mueller, a special prosecutor with full powers of subpoena, and he took years and years and $30 million to research it. They came up with, you know, he said there was no evidence for that. That was followed by Mr. Horowitz's report, who was the special inspector general, who also looked into the allegation. He found that actually a lot of the crucial evidence, like the so-called dossier, the Steele dossier on Putin's misbehavior, or Trump's misbehavior with the Russians, was all made up. We now have another special prosecutor about to report, Mr. Dunham, who seems to be, you know, further explaining how the evidence was manufactured. So I think I can feel fairly confident that what I said as a fairly lonely voice back in 2016 has been borne out by the most, you know, by a whole bunch of official investigations.
In general, you imply that actually it doesn't matter who's in power, Republican or Democrat, Trump or Obama, that the military-industrial complex carries on regardless. And you've also got this revolving door where people like Jim Mattis can be one minute working for an arms company and the next minute be advising the government. So there is no change on the horizon. It's like reversing the Titanic.
Well, I'm afraid that's, you know, that's true. I mean, you know, hope springs eternal. So I think that maybe if people wake up, I mean, think about it, as you started, you know, this program, you quoted Dwight and President Eisenhower warning about the military-industrial complex in January 1961. And if Dwight Eisenhower, you know, great military hero, much loved president, enormous prestige, you know, if his words, you know, he clearly, no one could deny he knew what he was talking about. If that got effectively ignored, which it was, and people sort of referenced it and said, oh, yes, and at least gave us a praise in the language, but it had no effect on the power of the military-industrial complex, I'm not sure what would. And as you say, and as I certainly say, you know, it doesn't really matter who's in power. I mean, the budget, it's very interesting, as I say in the book, you know, the budget overall has increased at a steady rate of, I mean, it goes up and down, but overall the rate of increase since 1954 for military spending has been 5% a year. And whenever it dips below, it doesn't matter who's in power, whenever it seems to be dipping below that trend, there's a, you know, someone discovers a huge new threat, you know, a missile gap or a budget spending gap or a missile defense gap. It doesn't matter. Something comes along to protect it. And, you know, even when there's you know, there's been an outbreak of peace, you know, like at the end of the Vietnam War, the end of the Cold War. You'd have thought, well, you know, we just two major military operations, just to name those two, which were being used to justify huge defense budgets, suddenly go away or eventually go away. You'd think there'd be a big cut in defense spending. Not so. I mean, it dipped a little bit in both cases, but not for very long. And soon it was up beyond its former levels.
So much for the peace dividend, right? You say, actually, I just want to get this nuance in, because it is a bit of a nuance. It's not that the budget is propelled by foreign wars. It's that the wars are a consequence of the quest for bigger budgets. I mean, that's quite a claim, right?
Well, yes, but it seems to be, you know, in a way referencing what I just said. I mean, you find the wars, I mean, I'm not talking about World War II here, which was something different, you know, when there was a really existential threat to the U.S., to, you know, to the democratic world.
You're not talking about Afghanistan either, presumably, because there was...
Well, Afghanistan, I mean, think about it. Not that, you know, I want to be speaking up for the Taliban in any way, a very noxious bunch, clearly. But, you know, on September 11th, 2001, the U.S. was attacked by a bunch of Saudis who, I mean, I do get into this in the book, but and there's every evidence that they were, you know, supported and, you know, encouraged by sections of the Saudi government. So
I wanted to talk to you about that, actually, because there is an increasingly evident link between 9/11 and Saudi Arabia that will, I'm imagining, shortly be undeniable, even though it's extraordinary that it's been denied so far. Will it affect U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia?
Well, evidently not, I'm afraid. I mean, it should. But given that, you know, as I, you know, going, you know, on September 12th, we knew by September 12th, 2001, that the 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. And the next thing we saw was a picture of the Saudi ambassador on the sort of balcony on the White House smoking cigars with President Bush. But the trouble is that Saudi Arabia is too important, bringing us back to our main topic, to the military-industrial complex as a sort of huge outlet for U.S. arms sales. And also, you know, a source of oil and all that, or at least we don't depend on it for oil anymore, but it certainly controls the world price of oil. So, you know, Saudi Arabia is too important for us to go and invade and bomb it, or even to sort of even to nominate it as the attacker. You know, I wish we would at least not go to war with it, but at least, you know, name the guilty parties. But we're certainly not going to do that. Instead of which, we went and invaded Afghanistan. You know, even though Al Qaeda, you know, was gone from Afghanistan in a matter of weeks, and then we stayed on for 20 years, you know, bombing and killing there. So it's no, that was definitely a war of choice, and a war of choice, I say, very much dictated by the need, you know, what we've been talking about all along, the imperative to feed the beast. You know, I quote in the book, I quote John Boyd, the great American, he was, you know, a great military thinker and a great fighter pilot, among many other things. And he said the strategy, it's not that the Pentagon doesn't have a strategy, it does. It's to feed them, keep the money flow and increase it. And that is, it is, I believe, and all the evidence I've come across over the years and I talk about in the book, that is, you know, the fundamental driving force of the whole machine.
Very good, if somewhat depressing, to talk to you, Andrew. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Andrew Coburn. His book's called The Spoils of War, Power, Profit and the American War Machine. It's a collection of his writings over the last six or so years. He's editor of Washington, editor for Harper's Magazine, apart from many other things.